You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to The Orthodox Nationalist. I am Matthew Raphael Johnson, and today's date is February 1st, 2025. If you didn't hear me, I forget when it was, a few weeks ago, I announced that I'm doing a project with Peter Quijones. I don't know if you're familiar with his show. He has quite a following. Twice a week, we're spending an hour going through the entirety of Solzhenitsyn's 200 years together. We finished part 9 today, and we're like at page 55. So this is going to be a very lengthy project, but I think worthwhile. If you're familiar with his show, go to his site. He has many of them, and everything from YouTube to every social media and Twitter, and check this out. I can't imagine that this doesn't interest you. It's really the first project of its kind. And really not too far away from that, one of the big issues for me over the last 15 years has been this project of New Khazaria. Khazaria is not exactly something that's known by your typical normie boomer type. Slowly, very slowly, it's penetrated certain areas of specialization. But the concept of New Khazaria, even though the idea has been around for a very long time throughout the history of the Soviet Union, it didn't really have that name, specifically New Khazaria, until Igor Kolomoisky and the rule of the Jewish oligarchs in Ukraine after 1992. The basic idea is that if things get very bad in Israel, where it's just not possible to hold the line forever, if the warfare just never ends, the Arab population keeps increasing, the glare of critics constantly on them for what's going on, their overstretched security services, the tremendous stress, I mean, you're dealing with out-migration as it is right now in Israel. If it ever gets to that point, there is another alternative, and that is basically the regions that made up the early medieval Khazar Empire. The idea of settling Jews in Crimea, that's nothing new. Lenin had an interest in that. But specifically connecting it with a Jewish homeland to actually replace the present-day state of Israel, that's fairly new. Now, the Khazar Khanate. I've been dealing with this for a very long time. It's one of the most violent, unpredictable, and yet wealthy of the early medieval empires. Once Attila the Hun died, the Khazars, one of the variants of the Turkic populations in the area, after Attila died, they came to fill the void. It's on the Black Sea, on the Volga side of the Black Sea for the most part, offering anyone who ruled that area tremendous financial benefits. There is no way to defend or to somehow justify the behavior of the Khazars, especially after they converted to Judaism. So Gentile authors living in fear often just avoid the issue entirely. Yes, the society as a whole, I don't mean every single human living there, did convert to some variant of Talmudic Judaism. Of course, Bulan and his son Obadiah had political motives. If they became Islamic, they would have then been a dependency on the caliphate. If they became Orthodox or Catholics, and actually this is prior to the schism, but it still existed regardless, you would then be a dependency possibly of the Byzantine Empire, or the Roman Empire. Judaism, for a whole bunch of reasons, the Talmud, it still maintains some kind of reputation as a legitimate religion, and still elevated its adherents above your heathen barbarians, and maintained freedom from both the caliphate and the emperor. You have many Arabs, roughly between 922 and 930, talking about the elite and many leading citizens being Jewish. I mean, you had groups like the Karai Turks converting, a few other small places, but they really didn't, they weren't big enough to really make a huge difference. But their staple, their economic staple, was taxing trade on the lower Volga, Dnieper, in and out of the Black Sea. They had things like fishing and agriculture, but mercantile trade and its taxation, that was the mainstay of the economy. They were also the main slave dealers to the Islamic market. Raids into Slavic territories were meant to capture slaves, using the island of Kaffa as their headquarters. But even after the destruction of the Khazar Empire, the system lived on. Places like the Volga Bulgars, and even the Turkic tribes that were used by Jews to continually raid Slavic areas. But even by the 880s, this very, very bizarre, disunified empire began to weaken. The foundations of Kievan Rus were being laid by people like Oleg of Novgorod. Even when other Turkic groups would raid, it was at the behest of the Khazars. And anyone who was doing that had to turn over 50% of their take to the Khazar Empire, to the Jews. And it served their interest because it permitted the Muslims and the Rus to fight one another, leaving the Khazars as these well-off middlemen. There were continuous attacks on the Khanate. Now, Oleg was defeated by them in 941, and as a result, the Khazars shut down the passage through the Volga. The Byzantines and the Rus were finding common ground against them, and war was coming. Too many, even like the Pechenegs, were coming into the Byzantine orbit. But it wasn't until Svatoslav I, who died in 972, took the capital city of Attil in 968, and the city was razed to the ground. And this is where the bulk of Eastern European Jews, the Ashkenazim, came from. That means, in a way, Khazaria can be considered a homeland for these Jews because, as many of them will admit, they ethnically derive from this group of people. So today's Israel in the Middle East continues to hemorrhage men and money in these constant wars. There are a few people, more than a few Jews, looking for alternatives. Now, I don't know how much of this I'm going to get to, but there is an entire theology now based around people like Rabbi Schneerson and the Chabad organization that permit the replacement of Jerusalem with Dnieper, or the new capital, or even Odessa, the new capital of world Jewry. But especially in Ukraine, now, you know, the coup that brought Judaism to Khazaria, there were several coups and revolutions that brought the same Khazars to power in Ukraine. The clearest, most blatant one was in 2014. And that oligarchy that had been ruling since the early 90s is almost exclusively Jewish. They seized power in the early 90s, then the Orange Revolution of 2004, and then, of course, the violent revolution in 2014. And upon taking over, they wanted to ban the Russian language, even in Russian-speaking areas, They passed the very early on the on the persecution of anti-Semitism, which was a law passed in Kiev, which calls for prison terms for what they consider anti-Jewish statements. But the project itself of building a new Israel, so to speak, a new Jerusalem, without calling it that, again, isn't new. It was an important part of early Soviet policy. Right after the October Revolution, Jews began to migrate to the left bank of the Dnieper, to the largest cities of Soviet Ukraine, which was created in 1919. Remember, in the 20s, the Bolsheviks began the forced Ukrainianization of the Russian population of Novorossiya. In the process, Jews created their own national districts there. They had Jewish schools and businesses conducted in Yiddish, and so the Ukrainian SSR had a huge Jewish population. The American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee was created by Jacob Schiff in 1914. But a few years later, they were a big part of Lenin's new economic policy and were investors in this project to create a Jewish republic in Crimea. Lenin established the Committee for the Settlement of Toiling Jews on the Land, put Peter Smidovich in charge. Another very similar group was created, headed by Yuri Larin, that same year. And the plan was to create three autonomous zones in the region south of Ukraine, one in Azov and two in Crimea proper, by 1930. Now, given the fact that there was a belief that these huge gold mines were about to be opened on the Chinese border, that project was moved to the Far East, the infamous Birobidzhan project, but that failed entirely. These national districts in Crimea were the Friedorf and Larendorf national districts. They were abolished by Stalin in 1939, resurrected again by members of the Jewish Anti-Fascist Committee. Solomon Mikol's Itzhak Pfeiffer had Molotov's sanction to go raise money and to resettle Crimea after the Germans were expelled. Then Shakhne Epstein approached Stalin with that same group of people in 1944 with a proposal to create the Jewish Soviet Socialist Republic of Crimea. That's why the Crimean Tatars were deported to Uzbekistan for their alleged collaboration with the Germans. But Stalin realized that this would cause more harm, to create tremendous anti-Jewish feeling among locals there, so the project was slowly abandoned. Stalin did encourage and help finance the Zionist project in the Middle East between 1944 and 1948, and remember, Israel initially was a Stalinist project and was recognized by Stalin and the Soviet Union first and foremost. But that same group, the AJC, continued its work and began to expand its activities in Ukraine, including Crimea, after the independence of Ukraine in 1991. There was even a plan to transfer Crimea to some international body to have a U.S. military base there. But that was, logistically, among other things, very difficult. But when Crimea returned to Russia in 2014, that was abandoned. And that's after that referendum, which showed the massive pro-Russian sentiment in Crimea for a whole bunch of reasons. That's where a lot of the hysteria came from, the illegal annexation of Crimea. Today, the post-revolutionary, meaning post-2014, government in Ukraine, they maintain dual and triple citizenship. The overwhelming majority have Israeli, some Cypriot and some American passports. There has been some moves, and it even passed, to ban this project, but it mostly dealt with anyone having Russian citizenship. That was a 10-year prison term at the most. We'll get to Igor Kolomoisky and his imprisonment, partially based on this. But of course, it's a law that was passed to shut people up more than anything else, dual and triple citizenship is still the norm amongst elite Jews. Remember, Kolomoisky had his citizenship stripped, so now he's just a citizen of Cyprus and Israel. So the concept of New Khazaria, with that name and with this semi-religious ideal, only really took root because of Kolomoisky. This is in part the Israeli resettlement to Ukraine, meant for the most part for the Donbas and Crimea. And it was important among Eastern European Jews before the war began, in both Ukraine and Israel. And it is true that the achievement of this depended on a mass depopulation of Ukraine, high Ukrainian casualties during a war. But no one expected this Russian victory to be so dominant and thorough, and everyone voting to join Russia, let alone the annexation of Crimea. This concept, in 2019, was Putin's advisor Sergei Glazyev wrote in Zavtra, talking about New Khazaria, and this is something that the Zionists were interested in. Jews in Ukraine aren't exactly shy in talking about this anymore, especially when you have such strict controls over the media in Ukraine. Bringing it up in Europe, well, that's a different story. Now, for the most part, the Jewish response to people like me talking about it is hysterical. Jews like Viktor Schneerman at the Institute of Ethnology and Anthropology in the Russian Academy of Sciences says the idea of New Khazaria is a conspiracy theory and a new anti-Semitic way of thinking. Alexei Marakin, political scientist, calls it an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory. Now, of course, these are thoughtless cliches, but I'm noticing and reading about this that none of these Jews are denying its existence. It's more like words of warning. There was a very weak attempt by the Kremlin to win some Jews over to its side in Crimea, but it was naive and rapidly abandoned. By the way, it's also news to this author. I came across it in the Russian press. It was news to me. But if it did exist, chances are it was to attempt to keep Israel from direct involvement in the conflict. Ukraine's economy, such as it is largely under Jewish control. And any attempt to win Jews over to the Russian side, that's seen as just Russia's actions as trying to take away their property. There was zero chance of any of them taking Russia's side. Although some of that might have changed, especially in the case of Kolomoisky. At the same time, Crimea is never going back. It cannot be reversed. It's a fait accompli. There's nothing anyone can do about it. But the rabbi of Sevastopol, Benjamin Wolf, said this, and I don't know if, you know, I don't think he's in the majority here, but let me quote him directly. This was before the war. At a meeting in the Kremlin with members of the European Jewish Congress, our President Putin stated that our country is ready to accept European Jews who are increasingly confronted with manifestations of anti-Semitism in their seemingly prosperous countries. As the President noted, in Russia, Jewish life, secular and religious, is developing not only in large cities, but also in other regions. Inter-ethnic and interfaith peace and harmony are a great asset. In Sevastopol, absolutely all conditions have been created for Jewish life, even for the most religious. In the very center of the city, there's a construction of a luxurious synagogue, Jewish kindergarten, Jewish comprehensive schools. And even Russian media are reporting that more than 40,000 Jews, citizens of Israel, have appealed to Putin with a request to grant them Russian citizenship and the opportunity to live on the territory of Crimea. Now, what is he really saying here? What he's saying is that the price for Jewish support was to accept the idea of New Khazaria, which, of course, is out of the question. These kind of naive attempts to win the favor of Jews, it goes back to the reign of Tsar Alexander I, who was terribly naive in that department. But that's hardly confined to Russia. Now, Putin's opinion of Jews is very complex. His anti-Zionist credentials are beyond dispute. He does say that the earliest Bolshevik revolutionaries were overwhelmingly Jewish. But, of course, he's also a politician, and he has to make sure that Tel Aviv doesn't get exceptionally involved in the Ukraine war, despite the fact that most of the Jews on the planet support Ukraine in that regard. We'll talk about that too here in a minute as to why. Now, Kolomoyskyi was not working by himself. The Chabad sect is very wealthy, Hasidic group that is working to create this, and they have been very open about it. That's beyond dispute. But the war has turned it into a double-edged sword. Ukraine is being cleansed for a new Khazaria, Sergei Danilov said, but that was in 2016. The Ukrainian politician Igor Bukut, also in 2017, said that Israel lacks living space and therefore its people, within the framework of heavenly Jerusalem, are laying claim to five southern regions of Ukraine, Odessa, Dnipro, Zaporozhye, Kherson, Nikolaev. Now, Bakut personally is a Ukrainian politician, and he was a leader of the pro-Russian party Great Ukraine, founded in September of 2006. He's also a veteran of the Afghan War. It's not a shock that he was arrested in 2020, and as far as I could see, his party was dissolved, although he never had any representation in the parliament. His website is operational, but the content doesn't seem to reflect his views. It has a .ua suffix, but I think it was taken over rather than shut down. Anyway, also in 2017, General Grigory Omelchenko, Security Service of Ukraine, who served in the Rada for a very long time, talked about this plan for a new Jerusalem in these very same five regions. The center would be Dnipro. Its cultural capital, of course, would be Odessa. The deadline was supposed to be 2025 to resettle about 5 million Jews from Jerusalem and other places. He says that when he said this November of 2017, 12 leaders of the new republic had already been chosen. Again, all before the war. I mentioned Sergei Glazyev, Putin's advisor on regional economic integration, said in 2019, sort of said that Zelensky, on Donald Trump's orders, would allegedly hand over Donbass to the Israelis. He said, perhaps the bet on Zelensky, made long before these elections, is connected with the general tilt of the Trump administration towards the far-right forces in Israel. They will probably pose new challenges for the renewed Kiev regime. I don't rule out, for example, the possibility of mass migration to the lands of southeast Ukraine, cleansed of the Russian population by residents of the promised land, tired of permanent war in the Middle East, just like Christians fleeing the Islamicization of Europe. Well, of course, Crimea is no longer under Kiev's control. There were some settlers prior to the war, but that's no longer the case. The war succeeded in depopulating Ukraine, but not in a way that the rabbis wanted. The areas, specifically, that were going to be the foundation of new Khazaria, largely under Russian control. That doesn't necessarily mean the project is a dead letter. Boris Filatov, the deputy head of the eastern city of Dnipro, one of the key Jewish centers of eastern Ukraine, in 2014, he said this in the media project Jewish Kiev. What to do with all those who sincerely wish death to my country? With the fabulous Russian idiots who sincerely do not understand that we are ready to kill them? With the vile Russian journalists whom the tongue does not even dare to call people? With this host of evil spirits, tomorrow will be a new day and the sun will rise. And what will the evil spirits do? We will have to build a new country, a city on a hill, New Zion, the promised land. Kolomoyskyi and Chabad and Dnipro and Odessa have been financing this project for several years, the so-called New Zion. This is why Chabad was so, the Hasidic movement was so heavily involved in the Ukrainian so-called anti-terrorist operation. That was the punitive operation to try to retake Donetsk and Luhansk starting in 2014. That counter-revolution was a huge blow to New Khazaria. Now, of course, Russia's invasion ruined these plans. Kolomoyskyi is in prison at Zelensky's orders. The cabal itself in Kiev seems to be in serious trouble. I don't think it's an accident that that referendum on Crimea, which sent the world's Jews into hysterics, took place on March 16th on Purim. Now, one of the major figures, if not the most dominant Jewish figure, Shmuel Kamenetsky, who's actually 100 years old, he's still alive, called the spiritual leader of the Jewish oligarchs. Not a whole lot of people have heard of him, but he remains one of the most influential religious figures on the planet. He founded the Talmudic Yeshiva of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, member of the Council of Torah Sages. He backed Donald Trump for president, at least in the first two campaigns. I'm not sure about the last one, because of his policies towards Israel, Zionism. But Kamenetsky, the rabbi of rabbis, said this on 2014, actually the day of the referendum. "We have been living together with Ukrainians for 1,000 years, and Ukraine is our land. Today we will read the scroll of Esther, as it has been read for thousands of years on Purim. Today this reading has a special meaning. The new Amman, our common enemy with the Ukrainians, stands very close." Now, that was at the start of the war, the ATO, against eastern Ukraine. His meaning might not be clear at first glance. Now, of course, that war ended with a Ukrainian defeat, and the eastern republics became independent, and today are a part of Russia. This alleged special historical connection between Ukraine and Jews is only meant to underline the fact that Russia is the true enemy of both, and he uses the codename Amman, or Haman, the eternal enemy of the Jews, a symbol also used for Rome in Jewish texts. He's referring to Jewish power in the Polish and Soviet empires. I mean, after all, relations between Jews and Orthodox Ukrainians has been uniformly hostile since at least the 16th century. Purim, remember, is the Feast of Vengeance based on the murder of Haman in Babylon along with many of his people. In 2015, Andrei Adamovsky, who was the executive director of the World Jewish Congress in the East, talked about the favorable situation for security in Ukraine for Jews. Of course, something that the war ended. Zelensky, as we all know, is a Jew. He was a comedian with very little knowledge of politics. He was installed in power, ruled with about 50 Jewish deputies of the Rada. I don't know where they got this idea, but somehow they thought that the Crimean Tartars were their allies. But the events of 2013-2015 changed that view entirely. I guess they thought they could mobilize the Tartars against Russians. But the de-Christianization program of the current Jewish government in Kiev has been overseen by both Chabad and Zelensky, closing many, many churches as creatures of Russia. The loss of Crimea was a huge blow to the plans of Kolomoisky and Chabad, his patrons in the U.S. Of course, Chabad has its largest community in New York. And even worse was when Donetsk and Luhansk seceded, creating their own state, because eventually it's going to be followed by all of southeast Ukraine. It looks like the city on a hill, which is just another word for New Khazaria, the New Jerusalem, seems to be on its last legs. But I use the word seem. The builders of New Khazaria have, as everyone who listens to me knows, unleashed their hatred, their irrationality against Russia and the Russian nation, against Putin and his allies, calling over and over again the Russian president the new Haman, or Haman, emphasizing his patriotism, of course. He is aware of the plans of Kolomoisky and Chabad, and he also knows the real causes of the revolution of 2014. Of course, Kamenetsky, the rabbi of rabbis, he's talking about a totally different set of historical events. He's talking about the Khazar Khaganate, the Khazar Empire, and the Jewish power. That was a feature of Ukrainian-Russian life, at least in that region, consistently from then on. Khazaria in the 9th century occupied a huge territory, essentially from Astrakhan, the Caspian Sea, to the Dnieper, including Crimea. So once the capital city was taken, the Jews who fled the area didn't move all that far, but they did. You know, there was this huge spike in population of this very different group of Jews all throughout Central Europe and Eastern Europe. But prior to the 2022 war, the headquarters of New Khazaria was Dnipro, the third largest city in Ukraine in the east. In fact, it was such that Chabad Lubavitch, I can't do the guttural pronunciation that the Jews can. So you're just going to have to forgive me there. Chabad Lubavitch is what it's often called, was going to move from New York to Ukraine, making the city of Dnipro the capital of Khazaria. Maybe this isn't entirely a secular idea. They've kind of abandoned the whole Third Temple idea, or at least transferred it. How popular or unpopular New Khazaria is, I don't know, and I have no way of finding out. However, there is a theology to New Khazaria, and this comes from the Chabad Lubavitch group. It revolves around Menachem Mendel Schneerson, the last Rebbe of Chabad Lubavitch. He died in New York in 1994, who was recognized as the Messiah by most of his sect and many Orthodox Jews at the time. The Hasidic view, and not just the Lubavitch, is that he's going to be resurrected and take power over the world as a Jewish Messiah, of course, otherwise known as the Antichrist. At the same time, Kolomoisky built a temple for him that's already been built in Dnipro, the largest Jewish complex on the planet, was built by this billionaire years ago, and it includes a throne for the resurrected Schneerson, the Chabad Menorah Center, it's called. The two capitals, Dnipro and Odessa, not Jerusalem, are supposed to be the focus of Jewish life, using Schneerson as its central figure. They're not worried about this Messiah in Israel or Jerusalem. Instead, they focus on the resurrection of Schneerson to take his throne in New Khazaria. I mean, is it possible that Jews are finally admitting that they have no religious or ethnic connection with the Middle East, and that they are Khazar Turks, not Semites? That would be the admission of the century. But it also may explain the Jewish hysterics upon it being discussed in public, especially over there. Lev Gumilev, who I've cited many times before, wrote a book called The Zigzag of History. He's one of the great scholars of Khazaria, and he's the one whom, through reading, I learned about this from. He called the Jewish takeover of that empire, or that region, a coup. The result of which, the second person after the Kagan was the Jew Obadiah, the son of Bulan, who was Dagestani, the first major figure to accept Judaism. This coup, now I'm going to quote him here, and this is a very curious thing that Gumilev says. The circumstances under which this state coup, not so much a religious one, took place are veiled by many legends, all of which without exception seem fictitious. They all have one goal, to hide the true state of affairs from history. The same thing is occurring today in Ukraine. And of course what he's talking about was the victory of Maidan in February of 2014. And of course, it isn't as if there aren't legitimate reasons to be upset. If you're Ukrainian, you have many legitimate reasons to be upset with the state and the oligarchs. Yanukovych was anything but perfect. It's who channels that anger. They took legitimate issues and directed them against Yanukovych. Although the president didn't have much power when, you know, up against oligarchs and Kolomoisky. Yanukovych had some principles, but he was too pro-Russian. Chabad Lubavitch had huge support in the U.S. and the EU. So what happened in 2014 with the Chabad Revolution, with goals known only to a few initiates, Crimea was saved from this fate by Putin's quick action, and of course the revolt of Novorossiya against Kiev. Ukraine's poverty and depression, that's where the ideal New Khazaria was to be erected in eastern Ukraine, the throne of the resurrected Schneerson, and the admission that the Jews have no connection to the Middle East. Obadiah in ancient Khazaria, very intelligent, very devious. He had connections to the wealthy Jewish diaspora all over the world. There's nothing new about that either. In fact, he spent quite a bit of money to bring the wise men of Israel, so to speak, to come to Attil, the capital of that empire. This was the money used to finance that Jewish coup. Well, you have something very similar occurring in 2014. After that, all major government positions were distributed amongst Jews, and Obadiah himself took the title of Bek, which comes from the Arabic Malik, or Supreme Monarch. That means you had two governments in the Khazar Empire, the nominal Khan, who wasn't necessarily Jewish, the traditional ruler, strictly nominal, and then you had Obadiah and his successors who ruled more or less secretly. The nominal Khan was under 24-hour guard, was permitted to see his subjects maybe once a year, where the real business of ruling and dominating came from Obadiah and his successors. Gumilev wrote, and his authority, in my opinion, is unchallengeable, "The final penetration of rabbinic Judaism into the divided ruling elite of early Khazaria didn't occur to the beginning of the 9th century. Obadiah, Bulan's son, forced Talmudism on the empire's elite, and all local schools began teaching basic Jewish beliefs. A dual government was created, where the Kagan, or the Khan, was overshadowed by the Bulan clan, that is, Jews creating an ethnic shadow government. Judaism in its Talmudic form had already been accepted by the elite as early as 740, once the Muslims were driven out. The failed ancient Jewish revolution in Iran, or Persia, sent a small army of Jews north to Khazaria, where they were granted welcome by Bulan and his clan. This mass exodus easily plugged into the Jewish trading networks." Now, what is he talking about? Now, I can't dwell on the topic. It's going to be for another time. But Gumilev is referring to the failed Mazdak revolution during the early reign of Emperor Kaba I, who died in 531. Mazdak was something of a proto-communist. He was a member of the clergy, Zoroastrian. He claimed to be a prophet of Ahura Mazda. His movement was financed, at least early on, by the large Jewish population of the empire. But when it was certain that he would be defeated, the Jews took advantage of that chaos to carve out their own state, Mohoza, under their leader, Marzutra II. Now, from what sources remain, Mazdak, or Mazdakism, is almost identical to the later revolutionary movements in Europe. They even were promoting vegetarianism. Sexual revolution was dominant, rejection of any clergy or ritual, and some crude communism of property. All things needed to be held in common to oppose greed. But the property has to belong to someone. And it was clear that the Revolutionary Party clique would own that property. This group of Jews, though, once order was restored and their state overrun, fled north. They fled to Khazaria, and that's the origin of the Jews that eventually took over that empire. They had just finished financing what today we would call a proto-communist revolution. Ideology has always been a part of this. Now, we fast forward to roughly our day. Kolomoisky, who actually called himself the Kagan of New Khazaria, absolutely controlled the post-revolutionary government in Kiev. He installed Zelensky. He forced the state to carry out the orders of Chabad Lubavitch in the U.S. Yes, his arrest is curious. It's been a few years now. But there was a collective nominal Kagan. And people like Churchnov, Arseny Yatsenyuk, Avakov, Vladimir Nalevichenko, well, you know, mostly, if not all, Jews. But Kolomoisky was dominant. He distributed roles and appointed representatives to government positions. Clearly, there's a similarity between the Khazars and Ukraine after 2014, and it's not a coincidence. Kolomoisky completely controlled Zelensky's election campaign, even though it was a rigged election. His lawyer was even appointed by the U.S. as Zelensky's central campaign chairman. Any bureaucrat that might threaten Kolomoisky's interest was removed right away, like Rebel Shapka, a Russian Rebel Shapka, who was the prosecutor general at the time. His corruption, you know, that was no secret. And yet, back in 2023, all of a sudden, Kolomoisky's arrested for various corruption charges. Of course, Zelensky, despite being an accomplice, wasn't included in that. I guess that's not how democracy works. But there's first of all, Kolomoisky gets arrested. You had this flurry of anti-corruption laws. What's going on? First of all, any anti-corruption measure exists first to give the impression that there is some interest in that regard. But more importantly, it's meant to purge the elite of those who can no longer be trusted. From 2023 to today, the charges against Kolomoisky, they change, they increase, they get worse. Nothing's ever the same. Why 2023? Nothing changed about Kolomoisky. He behaves as all oligarchs do. His entire universe was corruption. So why now? Everyone with any power in Ukraine, including Zelensky, did exactly what Kolomoisky is being accused of. So obviously there's other factors at play, and the only thing that makes any sense is the wavering loyalty to Zelensky as his administration comes tumbling down. They've even used like a RICO-style investigation to seize his assets. If you've heard my latest Daily Nationalist, I go into great detail about what Zelensky said in his, early on, his inaugural speech of creating a new Israel, or I guess he called it a big Israel, an armed camp, so it's perpetually at war with its neighbors. But after the Maidan, what began was a transformation of Ukraine into an armed camp to challenge Russia in the east. But it's clear that massive casualties somehow in some kind of a war were required so that plenty of land would be available. Now, the oligarchs to a man have been supporters of Chaban Lubavitch, and they've invested a massive amount of money in that revolution. Putin is universally seen as a new Amman. Now, he may have ruined their plans, but that's going to depend on how far his forces are going to penetrate into Ukraine. There was a coup in Kazaria, as I've already mentioned, that victimized the tribal aristocracy. And it caused a civil war. The Hungarians sided with the rebels. Pechenegs, hired for money, sided with the Jews. It was merciless. This gave the character of the Khazar Empire as this vicious, absolutely merciless Machiavellian entity. This is an army that was, or you know, mercenaries based on total extermination. In 2014, the Kiev cabal sent military units from the western regions, the Dnipro Airborne Brigade, to the southeast of Ukraine. That only had a limited effect because the problem is people like Kolomoisky didn't trust its own citizens. Maybe the army's not going to shoot at its own people in this early state. So Kolomoisky placed the right sector of Dmitry Yarosh, who was a member of Chabad Lubavitch, hired at great expense to keep an eye on military formations. The entire payment for this punitive operation wasn't just paid by Kolomoisky, but of course the government of Arsen Yatsenyuk, who was subordinate to him. Typical of Chabad nonsense. And any expression of the true Ukrainian national will is banned and shut down. Eastern Ukraine, a mostly Russian-speaking area, sought freedom from this colonial state of affairs. The bloodthirsty essence of this regime, fueled by Chabad Lubavitch, led to, among many other things, I mean, the first bloodletting, other than the riots themselves, the slaughter in Odessa. May 2nd, 2014, mostly covered up in the American press, more than 100 Ukrainians were burned alive in the House of Trade Unions. They poured napalm into the building and set it on fire. This was filmed and viewed by Kolomoisky. And after that, Ukraine became a very different place. Now, the war in eastern Ukraine, which is coming to a close, is a continuation of the 2014 war, with just brief interruptions. Given the Jewish domination of this country, Ukraine became an unnatural combination of this amorphous mass ruled by an oligarchy alien to them, by blood, by temperament, by religion. It doesn't really have an ideology. It exists for power. After May 2nd, of that year, Ukraine lost whatever coherence it ever had. It was a burnt offering of Ukrainians in Odessa, an offering brought to the altar of Chabad Lubavitch, also the shooting of policemen in Mariupol on May 9, 2014, for refusing to shoot at civilians. So, of course, it's not surprising that after the referendum and the independence much later in Donetsk and Luhansk, the results of which were stunning for many sheltered analysts, the militias of Novorossiya, Donbas, began to carry out operations to completely destroy the Western-backed assault squads of Kolomoyskyi, both in 2014 and today. Will the fight for true independence, supported by millions of Ukrainians, will it stop at the border of the Donbas, or will it move farther west? Well, I think Kolomoyskyi had an idea about this before his arrest. He pumped out Ukraine's strategic oil reserve, and he sold it to the EU. That first tranche of the IMF loan in that era, it didn't pay for Russian gas, which you can't do, but it was divided between the top of the Dnieper Chabad and other Jewish oligarchs. This is how we know that this amorphous entity is leading towards its demise. We can say right now that the attempt to revive New Khazaria has failed. There is no way Ukraine could return to its previous life. The Kiev government will waver and flee, just like Yanukovych did, and many already have. This is why the Chabad-Lubavitch are creating self-defense units in Kiev today. Having put Kolomoyskyi in jail, it's not so much to create a defense, but to create escape corridors and just to buy time to export their assets abroad. Now, all of these national militias, they're all but gone. The Rubicon has long since been crossed, and you have people in Donetsk and Luhansk making plans for a march on Kiev and Dnieper to finally destroy this regime. Now, if Russia destroyed the dream of New Khazaria, is there any currency to this idea today? Well, some years ago, and I did it just last week again, I mentioned Zelensky's desire to turn Ukraine into what he called the Big Israel, which I see as a variation of the New Khazaria theme. Of course, with an entirely Jewish ruling class and non-Ukrainian ruling class, there's a lot no one has noticed here. But right in 2019, his inaugural address, he said, "We must become the Israelis, following their example in the defense of our native land." Zelensky met with the NATO elite in 2022, a few months after the war, announcing this plan. He had mentioned it before. Now, he had fled the country more than once, using the excuse of meeting with these people, but he returned with Western backing for the project. This Big Israel project, if you heard me last week, this is not only being financed, but there's an entire roadmap, a very bizarre roadmap that I talked about already, put together by the Atlantic Council, which is essentially NATO's official research arm. It was written by Daniel Shapiro, the American ambassador to Israel under Obama. April 5th, 2022, the war was fairly new. He said, Zelensky said, "We will definitely become a Big Israel with its own personality. We shouldn't be surprised that there will be representatives of the military or the National Guard in all places, supermarkets, the movie theater. There will be people with weapons." Now, the funny thing is that doesn't have anything to do with security against its enemies. Having armed men in the movie theater is unrelated to any legitimate defense interest. It has to be talking about something else. And that something else is a totalitarian means of keeping his ethnic and financial oligarchy in power. Now, of course, he first said this in 2022, but we're now February 1st, 2025. It's sounding more and more fantastic. It's a fantasy of the regime as time goes on. That's not exactly the original idea for New Khazaria in Crimea, but it may be a variant of it. Ukraine's best men, its best infantry, is either dead, they've defected, they've fled, they're POW, whatever. The country is permanently traumatized, hence incapable of concerted action. The only thing that exists is this parasitic oligarchical class that, up until recently, had the groundwork for New Khazaria laid out, very much like its namesake, this pinnacle of corruption. Now, the war gave Kiev an excuse. "Oh, we have a terrible economy because of the war." Well, their economy collapsed in the 90s. What this Big Israel nonsense is, and why he uses such extreme language, it's the creation of a totalitarian state, that is, a state that claims the right to regulate every aspect of human life. That, of course, has to be a financial and military dependency of the U.S. Kiev then would reproduce Israel's approach to chronic security challenges, as they say, against this imaginary Russian other existing only in the mind of the system. Russia doesn't threaten anyone except the criminal billionaires in Kiev. Ukraine's inhabitants, as of right now, have become landless proletarians. The only thing that saves them from starvation are these constant financial injections from their Western masters. Everything that had any value has already been sold. The only obstacle to New Khazaria was the land itself. So transferring ownership was very important. It became a big issue, even before the cabal took over in 2014, this particular one. Poroshenko had to deal with resistance to all of this. He couldn't pass a law on the sale of land, just minor amendments. So he was replaced by Zelensky, who was more suitable for the role of liquidator and dictator. It's why he needed to be the way he was. Valentin Katasonov, you know, I've quoted him before, one of my favorite economists in Russia. He went into some detail how the Jewish oligarchs, in the name of New Khazaria, took most of the Ukrainian black soil acreage. In order for the transfer of Ukrainian land, or really the theft from its original owners to the regime, the state adopted certain EU regulations to eliminate its previous owners. The adoption of these EU standards meant that the sale of private products from Ukrainian land had to adopt to certain legal and environmental regulations. For this to be done, huge investments were necessary, which of course Ukrainian farmers couldn't make. Therefore, the land ended up in the hands of large buyers, Jewish oligarchs who formed their conglomerates, and these transferred these lands to BlackRock as a holding company. Three American corporations were formed, and this was in 2018, already owned about a third of arable land in Ukraine. It got worse since Zelensky. The grain traded on any exchange coming from Ukraine is a property of American businesses, not Ukrainians. The website of the Ministry of Agrarian Policy and Food in Ukraine published data on the 524 land auctions of tens of thousands of acres of Ukrainian land put up for sale, total of 90 million hryvnia. Before the war started, another 5,000 took place. First 3 months of the war, Sergei Marchenko, Ukrainian finance minister, said $9 billion American dollars in credit funds were received and more was on the way. This was being used to buy up land. The lands were acquired in Odessa, Nikolaev, Kiev, Lvov, Ivano-Frankivsk. These massive land holdings of the former country flowed into private hands, with BlackRock, of course, controlling the lion's share. And this is how Ukrainians were reduced to landless proletarians. The oligarchs, perpetual scammers. One of the few non-Jews, by the way, is Nikita Putuarev, one of the new landlords, and they put him as a front man. He said, this new free market in land is the final burial of communism that deprived the Ukrainian people of their main wealth, the land. Of course, he was well aware he was doing the exact same thing. It comes out of the Servant of the People Party, the unofficial capital of Ukrainian Khazaria, Dnipro. Rabbi Kamenetsky announced that Putarev had been included into a special group of people. He was given the status of righteous among the nations as one of the few non-Jews involved with this scam. In Israel, on the other hand, the sale of land to foreigners is strictly prohibited because it's seen as a patrimony of Israel. Of course, Ukrainians are not permitted any such patrimony. Russian political scientist Mikhail Kazin talked about this topic. He said, to solve the problem, Western influential forces had to weaken Ukraine as much as possible to make the country a dependent state that cannot exist without external support, and a divided society that will not be able to resist. Then it was necessary to solve the issue of land, because those forces that won Khazaria are not Orthodox. The land of Ukraine already actually belongs to the majority of these people who are ready to create the new Khazaria on this territory. But at the moment, the special military operation suspended the plan to create it. It also became clear that not everything is going smoothly for the organizers of this scam. Let's hope that they will encounter many more difficulties on their way, which will make the implementation of New Khazaria impossible. I've been talking about this stuff for a very long time. Still, the concept is almost entirely unknown. But since the Hamas attack from Gaza, the unofficial decision of Zelensky was a strategic accepting of refugees from Israel. There is quite a bit of out-migration from Israel, some of its best people. They're getting a social payment of 20,000 hryvnia. It's been discussed. To what extent this money has been dispersed is another matter. Of course, all the money comes from the West anyway, but in Kiev there is no law. It's just the rule of the strongest. Of course, the population has very little to eat. Soldiers are barely paid. The billions from the IMF and those kind of organizations, they're never seen by the average Ukrainian. As far as the West is concerned, it's disappeared. We all know what that means. I've been saying for at least 10 years that the IMF is aware that its huge loans, that money will never be seen again. But the same ruling class wants to pay the Israelis, though. The Israelis have living conditions far superior than that of the average Ukrainian. Somehow, Zelensky has to find the necessary funds for payments to Israeli refugees from the multi-billion European tranches allocated for social services. But to one degree or another, these fertile lands will repeat the fate of Palestine, the attempt to create a new Israel on the banks of the Dnieper. But he is dealing with a massive manpower shortage. He's in no position to threaten anyone or do much of anything. But the plan to resettle a number of Israelis to Ukraine requires much of the country, as I've already said, to be cleared of its population. But that was a concept long before the war started. Right after the start of the special military operation, the pace of land sales to American corporations, Ukrainian land, accelerated dramatically. In general, the Black Soil region has about 40 million hectares. 17 million of those have already been sold to the dominant buyers are Cargill, DuPont, and Monsanto. And by the way, the main shareholders here come from BlackRock, along with its secondary underlings like Vanguard and State Street. The Ukrainian government, the BlackRock Financial Market Advisory, signed an agreement to create the Ukraine Development Fund, ending the sell-off of Ukrainian state assets. Well, that's because none of it remained. But I mean, BlackRock dominates everything. But let's get to the heart of the matter. Henry Kissinger, and whether or not this is 100% relevant is another matter. Kissinger and many others. In particular, he said, in 10 years, Israel will disappear off the world map. Mossad, even before the Hamas war, talked of a real threat to Israel's existence. People like the head of the National Intelligence Service, Tamir Pardo, he said that the continued occupation of the West Bank creates a risk of destroying Israel as a Jewish state. And these people are talking about demographic factors, the population issue. It used to be that many of the Hasidim are growing faster even than the Arabs. That's no longer the case. In East Jerusalem, there's a concern that Jews will be a minority. Of course, they promote that kind of thing everywhere else. You can't exclude the very, possibility of a unified Islamic attack on Israel. The only way that that would ever come to pass is if they've upped their genocidal policies, but I highly doubt it. It remains the case, whether that's true or not, that Jews are looking for a new geopolitical, a sacred geopolitical landscape. The basic plan, and I mentioned Igor Bakut of that great Ukraine party, Kolomoisky. The basic new Khazaria theory is that the population of Ukraine should not exceed 5 million. That Yiddish and Hebrew will still be at least a parallel language to Ukrainian. Igor Bakut, head of that party, he said this some time ago. Hopes that the state will arrange your life for your work are in vain. Today, the country belongs to a narrow circle of billionaires and multimillionaires who are either in power or control those who do. Who lives poorly? Those that cannot fit into the service of the state. They can only complain of their worthless life because the owners of our country are not obligated to take care of 14 million pensioners, the children, and the disabled. A research from the Berlin Political Institute. come to the conclusion that in order for the existing system to come into balance, 4 to 5 million people are more than enough in Ukraine. The rest should be eliminated, and in order for all sorts of poor and hungry teachers and doctors to disappear, they must be pushed to the edge of society and ensure that they do not live to see their pensions. When Poroshenko, Waltzman Poroshenko, was president, again also at the behest of Komoisky, there was an attempt to make Hebrew one of the official languages of Ukraine. There was a law on bilingualism. It came out near the end of Poroshenko's administration that there was compulsory Hebrew language study in all elementary schools. And that's why they brought up 2,000 teachers from Israel with their families to move there. Now, apparently, Poroshenko decided to eliminate this because even those who were backing the Maidan Revolution worried about how this is going to be received. But the biggest promoters of this, the so-called Ukrainian nationalists, Yarosh, Lyashko, Turchno, Yatsenyuk, these were the loudest pushers of this law. Kolomoisky went so far as to say that he wants to create a spare airfield in Israel, for Israel in Ukraine. It's obviously before he went to prison. If the war gets worse and worse, he's arranging this promised land for the Israelis. Now, the fact that Kolomoisky is in prison for ridiculous charges, I mean, they're true, but that's how everyone is. That doesn't mean, his nationalized assets went somewhere. There's other billionaires that could be doing the exact same kind of thing. Kolomoisky called himself, I shouldn't even say it was Poroshenko that sought this new exodus. He thought of himself as a second Moses. But even before this war started, the cleansing of the population, 4 or 5 million people at the most, and whoever's left should be serving this Jewish ruling class. So prior to the war breaking out, this is where the so-called national militias came from. It came from Kolomoisky to fuel a civil war in Ukraine. They were not expecting the Russian response. Now, the 2014 revolution was carried out. The direct financing, information, cover, and organization of many Jewish politicians and Zionist organizations, Israel, the U.S., the European Union. The Times of Israel, back in 2014, reported that Tel Aviv recognizes European Ashkenazi Jews as Khazars. Somehow that gives them a legal right to demand the return of their territories. They said that Jews can live in any territory of their historical residence as a sovereign people. We decided that this should be the shores of the Black Sea, where we lived as indigenous people for more than 2,000 years. The Times of Israel says this: all Jews who wish to return will be accepted back as citizens without any conditions, especially if they participate in the promised massive military aid, including soldiers, weapons, and the construction of new bases. The first batch of resettlement goes well, other settlers from the West Bank will be asked to resettle in Ukraine. After Ukraine regains control over its entire territory with the help of this support, the current autonomous Republic of Crimea will once again become an autonomous Jewish entity. And this was uttered long before the war. This was uttered during the war against Eastern Ukraine from Kiev. None of this took into consideration what was going to happen. None of this, when Putin invaded with a substantial militia who fought very well, continues to fight very well, coming from the Donbass republics, this struck fear and terror into everyone. That explains the ridiculous, hysterical, bizarre reaction to the Russian invasion. Now, I'm not saying that some of these nationalist militias didn't get the Jews scared sometimes. In fact, a guy named Eugene Satanovsky, one of my favorite Jewish names, head of the Institute of the Middle East, people like Viktor Eskin, a lunatic, and even Jewish leftists like Daria Metina, the notorious communist, started to worry about these fascist militias. Well, now it's irrelevant. Of course, they're gone. But while the regime invents stories about North Korean troops fighting for Moscow, despite the fact Moscow's using maybe 10% of its military power, Israeli troops have been involved. The Aliyah Battalion. I mean, the right sector was trained by the IDF. They spoke about this on television. IDF fighters were there from the beginning, just like they were there in trying to do the same thing in Georgia in 2008. They were invited by the chief rabbi of Kiev, Moshe Azman. These were some of the people also who created the incendiary napalm mixtures for the mass murder of the Odessa House of Trade Unions. It has to be noted, though, that the Jews of Odessa didn't necessarily trust these Gentile groups. Some of them went to the World Jewish Congress in New York calling for a leash to be put on right sector. And that was confirmed by one of the Odessa Jewish leaders, Mikhail Maimon. Jewish battalions were created at the time. Shabbat Lubavitch is creating battalions now. The first was to attack. Now it's to get out. The first one back in 2014 was Meitlan, supposed to recruit Jews, citizens of the former Ukraine and Israel, to attack Novorossiya. There was even another one, Chechen Jewish humanitarian battalion named after Benny Crick. Some of this stuff is actually being investigated by the Investigative Committee of the Russian Federation. The Investigative Committee, the main director of the Investigative Committee, was talking about this in criminal proceedings. Because there's plenty of people who gave the orders for the complete extermination of Russian-speaking people living on the territory of the self-proclaimed, at the time, Luhansk and Donetsk People's Republic. Most of these people, not all of these people, are Shabbat Lubavitch people. The only thing that stopped it was the Russian invasion. And, of course, the referendum from the Donbas republics to join Russia. Now, what does this mean for New Khazaria? The best that you can hope for, from their point of view, I mean, is that Zelensky's Big Israel totalitarian state be erected in Kiev and you know, whatever is not taken by Russia. The chances of that happening, I don't know. Even by his own constitution, Zelensky's not president anymore. His powers expired in May of last year. He has no legitimacy at any level. I mentioned before that they want to put that famous boxer, mayor of Kiev, into office, install him, you know, the fake election and everything else. That Zelensky has become quite a detriment to the regime. And I have the feeling they'll release Kolomoisky, despite the fact that a lot of this investigation into him came from the U.S. Zelensky, you know, Kolomoisky started saying things that maybe we need to start talking to the Russians here. You guys are, you know, we're losing. And all of a sudden, he's getting investigated. And, of course, has been said, he hasn't been convicted of anything. He doesn't have bail. Now they're trying to get him on murder or something like that, which, again, normal for Shabbat Lubavitch. That's the best that the Jews can hope for, thanks to the Russian invasion. Now, the future of Jewish power is in the hands of Putin and, to a lesser extent, the Orthodox Church. This is unprecedented. What's done with it? That's a separate issue entirely. New Khazaria seems to be a matter of history. Again, the closest they could ever come is this big Israel, this totalitarian system that Zelensky wants. But, of course, the whole thing assumes that he's going to be in power. I highly doubt that. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you again next week. Bye-bye.